And now on BBC Radio 4, in our book at bedtime, Stuart returns home to Stonemouth with the Merston family's threats ringing in his ears, but the reasons for their anger and his fleeing to London finally become apparent.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I ever change things that I feel?
A red Toyota Estate swings into the bus stop, splashing to a halt right at the entrance. The person inside leans over, reaching to push open the passenger door. My idiot heart leaps as I think, maybe it's Ellie. But it isn't. It's not Greer either. It's a guy I recognise from high school, I think.
Stuart, thought that was you. Want a lift?
Yeah, cheers.
Thought that was you, he says again.
He's Craig Jarvie from the year below ours.
Thanks, Craig.
Lauren McLaughley and Drew Linton were getting married the week before Ellie and me, and having a two-part honeymoon, a castle hotel in the Western Highlands and a designer boutique place in Santorini, so that they could attend our wedding too. The reception was in the Mernside Hotel, Stonemouth's grandest venue for nearly a century. I walked into the ballroom where the reception was being held, maybe 20 tables of 10 places each in one half of the room, leaving the other half free for dancing. I felt a sharp tap-tap on the back of my head, just above my neck. This would be Greer, her traditional greeting for almost as long as I'd known her. I turned and there she was, 17 and a goth, head to foot in black. "You have to dance with me," she told me, sounding very serious and looking at me from under her jet-black fringe. "No problem, Greer," I told her. I surveyed her black crepe long-sleeved polo-necked dress, black tights and black suede shoes. The heels were breathtakingly high. "I don't want to be called Greer anymore."
"Back to Greer?"
"Yes, on pain of death." She waggled her black fingernails at me. "I have powers, you know." At the welcome drinks tables, covered in glasses of whiskey, bubbles and Tropicana, I met Ferg. He was resplendent in full kilty outfit. I wore dark blue suede shoes, a perfectly serviceable pair of black M&S trousers, and a so dark blue it's black velvet jacket picked up for a pittance from a charity shop.
"Gilmore, you look like the croupier on an Albanian cruise liner. Anyway, who or what was that?"
"That? That was Greer. Greer Merston. Going to be my sister-in-law in a week."
"I think I quite like her."
"She's still a kid, Ferg."
"What? She's not even legal."
"She's 17. She's legal, but she's probably best left alone."
"Oh, am I being warned off?"
"Yes, seriously, pick on somebody your own gender." He looked at me and shook his head.
"Did you get dressed in the dark again?"
"Wait a minute. Your parents are away, aren't they?"
"You got dressed by yourself. It all starts to make sense now." "Holy piss up a rope, who's that?"
"Who?"
"There, in the red."
"Where?"
"There! Good grief! Did you see her already and whack yourself blind?"
"Ah, that's Jill. Angelica Makovet."
"Wasn't she the dumpy bairn that used to jump on your lap and tell you she loved you? Usually at a crucial point in doom, as I recall."
"I missed a few high scores that way."
"You wouldn't piss her off and give her 50p to go away now?"
A small boy suddenly appeared in front of us, clutching a camera in his chubby hands and pointing it vaguely towards Ferg and me. Drew's dad thought it would be a hoot to give all the small children cheap digi cameras. Ferg appeared confused.
"Drew? Who's Drew?"
I looked at him. "The groom, Ferg."
"Oh, that's nice."
I just finished my coffee after the meal. Ellie's cup of tea lay where it had been left, untouched, just like her main course had been. She spent most of the meal dashing off to see people and was currently nowhere to be found. I turned round as a hand rested on my shoulder.
"Jolie, good to see you."
Jolie McCall was my first girlfriend, the first girl I took on proper dates and had any sort of extended relationship with. I have to keep reminding myself ours was a relatively innocent relationship, because although we never did have full-on sex, there was a lot of everything else just short of it. Julie's attitude was that what we had was close enough to sex for it not really to matter. She wanted to stay a virgin, maybe until she was married and or settled down and had kids. I was just on my way to the bar. Get you anything? I'll come along. G&T for me. Any tips? What for? A happy marriage. Let me think. I know. Don't have children. Seriously. Your decision, the two of you, obviously. But yes, that's my advice. But you've got three. So I know what I'm talking about. They take over your life. They become your life. I sort of had plans, but, well. Another G&T. She smiled. Why not? You two okay? Said a concerned female voice, and I turned to find the stunning vision of curvaceous pulchritude that was Angelica Macavett, a vision in crimson at my side. A wave of her perfume rolled over me. Julie smiled. We're fine. Can I borrow him? Jell asked. It's an eightsome reel. All hands report to the dance floor. He's not mine to lend. You can have him. Stop groaning, Jell said, using a finger to flick me on the ear. She was wearing long red satin gloves. Do I have to? Yes. Stop being such an old man. Get your ass out there. My legs, my feet, my old war wound, I said, in a weak, wavering voice. Omens. Portents. A fire alarm went off just after the eightsome reel finished. I'm sitting here, Jell announced, lowering herself delicately onto one of three red, sun-faded plastic chairs, which looked like they were there for when the smokers amongst the staff wanted a fag break. I tried Ellie's phone, but it had no reception. Everybody else was wandering off towards the assembly area and the car park round the front. Go, go, Jell said when she saw me hesitating. I'm fine. See you back in there. The best part of 250 people were swirling about the car park. A big cheer went up from the crowd as Josh Macavett arrived in a taxi, fresh off a plane from London. I stopped to say hi, then went on trying to find Ellie. I walked down and along a terrace and found her in a clinch, basically, with the guy she'd been dancing with earlier. I recognised him now. He was the guy she'd gone out with before Josh Macavett, the guy I'd always suspected had been her first lover. Dean somebody. Dean Watts, that was him. They were on a terrace one level further down, standing, his hands cupping her backside. What the hell, was all I could think. What the hell? A breeze brought their voices and a hint of Ellie's perfume up to me. No, listen, Dean, stop. No, no, just stop. Oh, come on, old time's sake, El. No, I shouldn't have let you kiss me, let alone... No, come on, before somebody sees us. This should have been Dean's cue to look about, maybe see me. But he only had eyes for Ellie. Finally, she stamped on his right brogue with her heel and marched off for the nearest steps. There. Nothing had really happened. Just a blip. A trying, a testing, and Ellie had pretty much passed. At least as well as I'd have in similar circumstances, I supposed. The evening went on. Much drink was taken, much drunken dancing committed. The amount of camera flashing declined as power ran down both in camera batteries and small children, though not as much in either as one might have hoped. Greer insisted on consecutive dances, the second being a slow one, during which she pressed herself hard against me. I can feel your erection, she informed me, just before the song stopped. I was thinking about Ellie, I told her. Not Angelica Macavett. No, not Angelica Macavett. I see a lot, Greer whispered into my ear. I bet you do, but not Jell, El. El, Jell, Jell, El, Greer sing-songed. Ellie, I said firmly. Greer nodded and pressed in against me again as the last notes of the song faded. And she's thinking of Dean Watts. She stepped back, nodded. Thanks, Stuart, she said, and skipped off. My expression, I'm sure, must have been choice. I was at the bar. Think there's more coke going? Jell asked, grabbing my arm. I don't know. I could think of at least one other good reason Ferg and Josh were heading off somewhere together. Let's follow them, Jell said in a stage whisper, eyes big and bright. You take the lift, I'll take the stairs, I told her. This seemed like a splendid stratagem to ensure we didn't miss anybody, and also to avoid it looking like Jell and I were proceeding in a bedroomwards direction together.
Okay.
On the fourth floor, she perked up.
Emergency supplies, she said, and dug down her cleavage, feeling around inside her bra. She produced a little paper wrap.
Brilliant, but I bet these are all locked, I said, testing the nearest door, then going to the next.
Keep trying, she said, followed almost immediately by, aha!
It was a little lady's toilet, three cubicles.
Hey, we were drunk,
coked up at the same time. I'd seen Ellie snogging somebody else, and there is almost a tradition for people about to get married to have one last fling. I picked her up, her legs round my waist, thudded into the middle cubicle as quietly as I could, stood there for a moment while she reached down, locking the door. We'd barely begun by the time she thought she heard a noise.
Somebody looking in and leaving again, I whispered. False alarm.
Jell raised herself a little higher, then let go of the side walls, raising both gloved hands high over her head as she sank further down onto me. So tight and hot, I nearly came there and then. Half an hour later, I was standing trying hard not to grin my face off, talking to Ferg in the hotel foyer. He looked pretty happy too, though whether this was for similar reasons I hadn't yet inquired. Part of me felt guilty, of course, but another part of me, a more influential part of my headspace, it has to be said, was already writing off the whole experience. It had been, I was in the process of deciding, a line-drawing under fling, a last and very much final hurrah that meant I had kissed goodbye to the delights of other women with a fine, decisive flourish. So that was all right then. There was no warning. No hubbub or sort of raised general level of noise coming from the ballroom, just Ellie striding up to me, taking me by the arm.
You need to get out now, she told me, her voice flat.
She put her mouth to my ear.
Come on, she hissed, shaking my arm. My family's going to kill you. They know you screwed Jell. Everybody knows you screwed Jell. Now move.
We stopped at Mum and Dad's so I could grab a bag. 2 minutes after we left, Donald, Callum and Fraser were hammering at the door. They broke in, took long enough to establish I wasn't there, and left again. They'd shown some of the photos the children had taken on the big screen above the stage in the ballroom. Maybe about half the guests were still there and could be bothered to watch. The last couple of shots were taken from outside a closed cubicle. The first showed under the door a man's dark shoes on either side of the base of a pale toilet bowl, with his trousers fallen round them. A pair of red shoes were also visible, heels front to the camera. In the very last shot, a pair of red gloved hands could be seen, fisted as though in triumph, and raised high enough into the air to appear above the cubicle itself.
Stone Mouth was read by David Tennant. It was a Heavy Entertainment production. After the news, Michael Rosen and guests will celebrate Nonsense at an event recorded at Radio 4's More Than Words festival in Bristol, where he'll be filling a cauldron with nonsense poems, prose, limericks and tongue twisters, with a few nonsense sounds thrown